Well, very well. Thank you for that. Good afternoon to all of you. It is truly a pleasure and an honor to be with you in this incredible festival. This is my first time here, and I regret not bringing my family. Garth, you didn't tell me. There's a children's place here next time, so I bring my daughters with me. What I would like to talk to you today is taking the context of the conflict that I come from. I am a Palestinian. I live in Bethlehem. But if I want to talk about the history of the conflict and the situation, I could spend many, many hours and days doing that. So what I would like to do is talk a little bit about my family history and my background to put you in the context of the situation that I come from, because a lot that I do now has been affected in a great way by my family history and the experience that my family had. Like many Palestinians, when you tell them to state when their history began, even though we have a long history of living in the Holy Land, 1948 is the day that many mention. 1948 is the year that the war broke out that led to the establishment of the State of Israel and led to hundreds of thousands of Palestinians becoming refugees. And my family, even as a Christian family, was not exempt from that tragedy. In 1948, my grandfather was killed as he was trying to protect his family. We lived in Jerusalem, or the family lived in Jerusalem, in a neighborhood in Jerusalem where Christians, Jews, and Muslims lived next to each other as neighbors for many, many years. If you ever hear the argument that this is a historic conflict between Jews and Muslims that cannot be resolved, immediately shut that person up quickly. Because historically, not even too many years ago, we all lived together as friendly neighbors. In 1948, when the war broke out, my grandfather was trying to protect his family. He had seven children. The oldest was 7 years old, and the young 12 years old, and the youngest was 2 years. And the only way he could protect them in the area where the fighting was taking place by was through his attempt to raise a white flag on top of his house to show both sides, the Arab forces and the Jewish-Israeli forces, that there are Palestinians or civilians that live there. As he placed the flag on top of his house, he was shot by a sniper from the Israeli side, and he died on the roof. It took several hours for his children, my father was 9 years old at that time, to actually go up to the roof and drag his body down and bury him right inside the front yard of the house. And it wasn't a few days after that tragedy that happened that that neighborhood was taken over by the Israeli forces, and my father's family was kicked out from their home. So you could imagine these children and their widowed mother who lost everything, their father, their home, their land, their property, everything that belongs to them. Now they were kicked out and we became refugees. They moved to Bethlehem because this is where we had family. And my grandmother was not able to support seven children, as well as this family that they moved in with. So she sent all her children to orphan homes. Lived very, very terrible conditions. And my father actually talks about an experience he had where for years he would own one pair of shoes that he had to grow into and keep changing and adapting and gluing the shoes so he would be able to fit in it. Very little food, very little warmth. And just have this image from going, being a beautiful middle-class family to losing everything. And what are the options for that child? Hatred, retaliation, revenge are very, very easy options. But my grandmother was a person who was very faithful. And she taught her children not to take revenge and not to retaliate for what happened to our family. That they should always seek reconciliation. They should always seek forgiveness to those who did this. Her famous statement, even until her death, was that if that soldier knew your father, he would not have pulled the trigger. And this is a message that has come to us as a second generation as well, the second generation of the Awad family. The children would meet once a year around Christmas time. And again, my mother kept insisting that this is the message that they should live with. The Lord blessed us as a family, and my father was able to go to the U.S. and continue his education when he was sponsored by a Christian family in the U.S. to do that. And then he returned in the late 60s because he got a very, very important call from his mother. It is a call that many, many Palestinians get. Can you guess what call that is? You're old enough. It's time to get married. And my father immediately said yes and came back from the U.S. And my grandmother took him to Gaza, to the Gaza Strip, where she had heard about this beautiful woman in Gaza from some other relatives. And my father, being a very obedient son, went with his mother to Gaza, not knowing what he was going to see, and met this beautiful, beautiful woman from Gaza, immediately falling in love with her, immediately asked him to marry him, and her immediate answer was, no way. Completely rejecting him, breaking his heart. But my father insisted on this, and it took 2 years of many letters, no emails or faxes or SMS or Twitters at that time, many letters from the U.S. to Gaza, and then the person who became my mother surrendered and said yes. I was born in the U.S. in 1971, but I returned back to Bethlehem with my father and mother when I was 6 months old. So I grew up all of my life in Bethlehem. Grew up in a time of occupation. The occupation of the West Bank began in 1967, as you know. So all of my life I grew up living under occupation. The only experience I have with Israelis was soldiers and settlers. They all had guns. They all hated us. They all did not want us on this land. We were a nuisance to them. And they just had to deal with us long enough to find a way to get rid of us. It's not a feeling, it's the experience that we had from them. And as children, I grew up with many Palestinian children either fearing them or avoiding them or running away from them every time we saw them. And if they stopped us, we obeyed them. Whatever they told us, we had to do. This is the way to be safe. This is the way to survive under occupation. But I grew up at that same time in this family that said, seek reconciliation, seek forgiveness. So I'm seeing this injustice, living it, seeing my father being abused by soldiers who were just a few years older than me. And I'm at the same time, my father and my grandmother are telling me, seek reconciliation. How do you do that? It was very challenging for me, especially with the real anger that I had in my heart. And the person who opened an answer to me was an uncle of mine who in the mid-80s had come back to Jerusalem, to Bethlehem, and started a center where he began teaching Palestinians about nonviolence. Now, you're here to hear about nonviolence in Palestine, and this is maybe where my lecture begins. Mubarak Awad was his name, and he opened a center called the Palestinian Center for the Study of Nonviolence. As a teenager, I loved going to the center because there was always activities to do, always things to do. My uncle would engage in protests and demonstrations against occupation that were very peaceful. Not just peaceful, but very peaceful. Planting trees in lands that were going to be confiscated to build illegal settlements. We would go and plant trees, and then the army would come and uproot the trees, and we would go and plant them again and work with the farmers in these areas. Campaigns to encourage Palestinians to buy their own products and to plant their own products. The first boycott campaigns of Israel started in the mid-80s. Now, the history of nonviolence in Palestine did not begin with the Center for Nonviolence. As Palestinians, we could actually say that we have a proud history of engaging in nonviolence. That goes back even as far as the 1930s, when the British had occupied us. I'm not going to blame you for anything. But during the British Mandate in 1936, Palestinians engaged in what's known as the six-month general strike, a nonviolent action that even Gandhi looked at and said, this is something that we need to learn from. And throughout our history, Palestinians continued to engage in nonviolence. In the mid-80s, there was this movement that began with the Nonviolence Center. And what my uncle was trying to do was saying that, yes, we have a history of nonviolence. Yes, we engage in nonviolence. But how can we build comprehensive strategies that the entire population can be involved in? Not just nonviolence as reacting to what they do to us, but truly engaging in proactive nonviolence. And I found a place for me in that, where this anger and rage that I had in me now could be addressed in a way where I'm not physically hurting the opponent, those who do injustice to me. I'm not even spiritually hurting them or even mentally hurting them, but are truly voicing my frustration about the injustice that is happening to me and demanding for my rights in ways that his rights and her rights are also honored and respected as well. In 1987, the first Palestinian uprising broke out. And historically, the first uprising is seen as a real case study of a population engaging in nonviolence. Demonstrations, protests, boycott campaigns, civil disobedience, communities like Beit Sahur, where Garth is very famous, near Bethlehem, completely refused to pay taxes, burned the ID cards that were forced upon us by the Israeli government. It was a very, very powerful time. And this is the first time that Palestinians actually from the occupied territories rose against the occupation without even consulting with or getting the permission from the leadership. That was in Tunisia at that time, the PLO. They were as stunned as the Israeli government and military when the Palestinians said, we will wait for nobody, we will take charge of our future by ourselves. In 1988, my uncle was arrested by the Israeli government. He was put on trial. It was quite a big trial, received a lot of publicity. And in June of 1988, the Israeli High Court came with a decision that said that Mubarak Awad is a threat to the national security of Israel, and we have to get rid of him. And the way they got rid of him was by deporting him, kicking him out of the country. A nonviolent activist, a peace activist, who for the first time actually was the person that introduced me to a group of Israelis I did not even know existed, the Israeli peace movement, who probably had more Israeli friends than Palestinian friends, he was seen as a threat to the national security of one of the most powerful countries in the Middle East, and he was kicked out. And that was a very big awakening in my life. What is in the power of nonviolence that would make a country like Israel shake from one peace activist? And I committed my life at that time to studying and engaging in nonviolence. I was 16 years old at that time, and I became very active, and I think a little too active for my father. You know, my famous uncle was kicked out of the country. I have to fill his shoes. So my father said, you're out as well. So I was kicked out by my father to go and live with another uncle in the U.S. where I continued my education. In 1996, after I completed my education and my master's degree in peace studies, I returned to Palestine. At that time, we had something called the Oslo peace process. You might have heard about it. People were very excited about Oslo. Finally, Israelis and Palestinians had recognized each other. They were ready to engage in negotiations. They were ready to put an end to this conflict that has lasted for so many years. As we know, the peace process failed. Negotiations failed. And in the year 2000, we went into another round of violence that has been the worst in the history of that area since 1967. Seeing Palestinians and Israelis killed on both sides. And I will not even go into saying more of us than them. Because when it comes to violence and when it comes to killing, you cannot make this argument to a Palestinian mother or an Israeli mother who lost a child. It doesn't make her feel any better when you tell her only we lost only a few, but we lost more of them. For her, her child has been killed in violence. As an organization, in the year 2000, we said we have to engage again in how to push nonviolence in the community. And we began doing this through trainings, through different activities, and so on. And we received a lot of rejection from the Palestinian community, as well as more rejection from the Israeli military and government. The first is that the Israeli military and government actually do not want Palestinians to engage in nonviolence. And I'm not saying that they want us to engage in violence. They actually do not want us to engage in any form of resistance, violence or nonviolent. But they know that nonviolence is more powerful than violence. And since their 2000, there has been tremendous suppression of any Palestinians who actually begin to organize in nonviolence. Many activists now who are engaged in nonviolence are now in Israeli prisons. There are restrictions on us continuously. For example, me as a person, I cannot go to Jerusalem, I cannot travel into Israel. Garth doesn't know this, but just last week, the last threat I received from the Israeli military governor was that they are thinking of preventing me from actually leaving the country to speak outside. And I had one response to that, which was, that will make my wife happy. But this is how powerful nonviolence is. Even speaking about nonviolence internationally, not engaging in action and activity, is something that is threatening to the structures of oppression and injustice. So the Israeli government has engaged in suppressing the Palestinian nonviolent movement. In the year 2000, when the uprising happened, it had the potential and actually the desire for it to be a nonviolent movement. Protests and demonstrations, very similar to what happened in the first uprising in 1987. Again, with this policy to try to suppress any nonviolent action, the Israeli government and military, and notice that I talk about government and military, not the people. I always like to make this distinction between the Israelis and the government and military, engaged in acts to suppress any nonviolent action. More Palestinians were killed in the first 2 months of the second uprising, which began in the year 2000, than in that entire year after. And as Palestinians were being killed and as blood was being shed in the land, in these demonstrations that were fairly nonviolent in their nature, immediately the Palestinians, especially some of the militant groups, some of the extremist groups, went from this, it's not just about now resistance, it's not just about demonstrating, it's about us taking revenge and retaliating for what is happening to us. We want them to feel the pain that we are feeling. We want their mothers to cry like our mothers are crying. And this is where you started seeing the Palestinians engage in the violence, in the armed resistance, in the suicide attacks that your media was filled with during that time. It was purely for acts of retaliation and revenge, not as strategies of resistance. And of course, once we begin having violence happen from one end and the other begins to retaliate for their violence, we fall into this spiral of violence, the circle of violence, where it has no beginning and no end. You could blame now who started it. It doesn't matter anymore because now everybody's just engaging in retaliation and revenge. But as an organization, we said our commitment has to be in nonviolence. And for us, nonviolence is very important for several reasons. I would actually make the claim that I feel that the only way to end the occupation, the only way to bring peace and justice to Palestine is through nonviolence. It's not just an option, it is the option. And I say that for several reasons. And this is what we're seeing now. The first reason is that strategically, nonviolence is really the only option. Strategically talking, when you engage in wanting to resist somebody who is oppressing you, you don't engage with them in the game that they are good at. If a sumo wrestler wants to hurt you or is treating you wrongly, you don't challenge him to a sumo fight. Maybe you're better in chess. Try to convince him that chess is a better game and win in chess. And this is the idea strategically. Strategically to understand what is your strength, what is your weakness, what is the other strength, what is their weakness, becomes very important to understand how to engage with them. As Palestinians, when it comes to military academies and military studies and schools, we are probably the worst in the world. We actually don't have them. We don't have soldiers who are trained to be militants or military. We don't have the camps to do that. So even for us, our strength is in the people themselves. And this is what nonviolence is about. It is about empowering communities to say we can lead our future. We can determine our future. And this is something that we see very clearly in the Palestinian community. Our strength is in the people and in our unity. Another very important point of nonviolence is that nonviolence exposes the injustice. Nonviolence does not allow for any excuse for the occupation to continue. We are seeing settlements being constructed all over the West Bank, settlements that are considered illegal in international law and UN resolutions. We are seeing a wall that is being built now on Palestinian areas, a wall that is dividing up Palestinian areas in the West Bank like Swiss cheese, a wall that is in Bethlehem, for example, completely surrounding Bethlehem, where there are only three ways to go in and out of Bethlehem, and all of them are through Israeli checkpoints. And this is just Bethlehem. And there are many, many examples. A wall that is built, 95% of it, inside the West Bank. Only 5% of it is built on the historic line between Israel and the West Bank. 60% of the West Bank will be taken over by the Israeli government and military, and the Palestinians will only have access to 40% to establish what Tony Blair, what Obama, what even Netanyahu, even our own president calls a Palestinian state. A state that cannot live, that cannot survive in such conditions. And this is what the challenge is. And the argument that is made continuously by the Israeli government and military is that we have to do these things for security. We have to do these things because there is violence from the Palestinians. And this is again where nonviolence becomes successful. Because when the Palestinians only engage in nonviolence, all of these arguments of security, of fear in Israeli society, will no longer have merit. And they will fall on their own. And what nonviolence will do is that it will not actually bring the wall down. Palestinians will not bring the wall when they engage in nonviolence. Those who will bring the wall down when Palestinians engage in nonviolence are the Israelis themselves. They will see that their government and their military have done the Palestinians wrong and have done them wrong as well. They will see how the occupation is hurting the Palestinians and hurting the Israelis themselves. They will see that the fear that they have lived in for so many years is a fabricated fear by their government, and they will demand an end to that as well. So as an organization, we engage in this as well. How can we engage in actions that do not physically, morally, or spiritually hurt the other side, but make them realize that they are as much a victim of the occupation as we are on the other side of the wall? The third important issue for me when it comes to nonviolence is one that has become a very recent issue in understanding the power of nonviolence. And this issue deals with something that I would have said I did not want to touch in the past. And I believe it was God who led me to this understanding. A few years ago, I was invited to attend a conference in Poland, in a place called Auschwitz. Some of you have heard of it, and some of you maybe have been there. The first time I wanted to go there, I was actually denied by the Israeli military governor from Bethlehem from actually leaving Bethlehem to go to Auschwitz. When I was interrogated by him, he told me, "This has nothing to do with you. Auschwitz has nothing to do with the Palestinians. And there is no reason for you to go there." The second year, the restrictions were much less, and I was able to leave and go there. And it was one of the most incredible experiences of my life. And I realized in this experience that nonviolence is not just about resistance. It is not just about organizing demonstrations that are taking place even right now in areas like Bethlehem. in areas like Ramallah. You might have heard of them. Bil'in, Ni'lin, Mi'asara, where Palestinians, Israelis, and internationals are engaging in these acts of resistance to expose the injustice and to build strategies to empower people. But there is even something more powerful about nonviolence, which is nonviolence is a mechanism and tool for healing as well. And what I realized in this journey to Auschwitz, where I was there for 10 days, in retreat, in prayer, on the ground in Auschwitz and Birkenau for that entire time, is how much the Holocaust is so much part of the Israeli mentality, of the Israeli psyche, of the Israeli trauma of fear that they live in. And as I would be sitting with a group that included Jews and Muslims, would be doing meditation or prayers, we saw hundreds of Israeli children, teenagers, come escorted by Israeli guides into a place like Birkenau. If you remember the movie Schindler's List, that train track that goes into the death camp, they would have them walk on that track with Israeli flags, singing very nationalistic songs. And then they would do this tour, and then they would have them sit in circles and begin a discussion with them. And these Israeli guides would stand in the middle of the circle, and every guide said the same thing. He said, look what happened to us. Look what happened to our ancestors. Look what happened to our grandparents in Auschwitz. Look what the Germans did to us. And some of these children actually lost their grandparents or great uncles and aunts in these camps. So you could just imagine the trauma that they were in. And you'd say, like, this is beautiful that, you know, you hear this and you want them to say, let's not have this happen again. This would be the normal thing to say. And every guide said the same thing. He said, you see what happened to us? It has not ended. If given an opportunity, the Palestinians are going to do the same thing to us as the Nazis did. The genocide, the Holocaust continues today. And this is why we have to suppress the Palestinians and we have to liberate, or actually they use the term cleanse, our land from the Palestinians. And you can imagine these children, 13 to 16 years old, going through that experience of the history, seeing and witnessing in firsthand what their grandparents experienced, and then being told, guess what, it's not over. Every Israeli child would come back from there, and if you know that or not, every child has to serve in the Israeli army. So they are even given the tools on how to deal with this potential threat from the Palestinians. And never are the tools of nonviolence. They are only the tools of violence that are given to Israeli soldiers on how to deal with the potential Nazi, the new Palestinian Nazi. At 18, this child is given a machine gun and thrown at a checkpoint and is told, deal with it. And just imagine. And for the first time in my life hearing this, I started really seeing what this child is seeing in me at the checkpoint. I've always seen him as an abuser. I've always seen him as the person who controlled me. I've always seen him as the person who suppressed me. But now I see him in his fear. In his fear that has manipulated him to see me as a potential, as a real threat to him as well. And this is where nonviolence takes a new form, a new transformation, in that nonviolence must be a tool for healing. The world has completely ignored and neglected the trauma and the fear that exists in the Jewish community. The only thing you have done is giving them a blank check and told them to put whatever number they want on it and have given them a blank agreement or veto on every UN resolution that condemns them, that tries to put them in alignment with international law. The only thing that the world has done is continue to enforce the addiction to fear in Israeli society. And what I say now is that as a Palestinian, it is my responsibility, because the world has ignored this issue, it is my responsibility as a Palestinian to engage in actions and activities and even in a language that addresses the trauma that is faced by the Israeli Jewish community. Even as a victim of the situation that I am in, empowerment to me comes when I say that I want to heal the other side from their fear as well. This is something not easy, and not many Palestinians actually like to hear that. Because from one end, it's good to say that you're the victim. You know, to say as a Jew that you're the victim of what happened. But from another end, it's even better to say you're the victim of the victim. As Palestinians, we need more pity from the world. We need more sympathy from the world. We need more support from the world. Because look, those who suffered the Holocaust are doing this to us. And this mentality of victimization only ends in one thing, destroying both us and them. The moral fiber of the Jewish society is being destroyed by Israel. And by this trauma and the fear that they live in, that is manipulated by their government. Bless you. Nonviolence has a long way. And there are many things that are missing that are very important for nonviolence to take place. As I said, one of the big missings is that within Israel itself, they are not realizing how powerful nonviolence can be as a strategy and as a tool to heal them. But the big missing for us in Palestine is also a leadership that is committed to nonviolence as well. Our leadership is not understanding that only through nonviolence liberation can happen. And it's not just about negotiations. It's not about even resistance. It is how can you empower entire community to deal with this issue? What we seek through nonviolence. You know, many people may be wondering, well, what is your end goal? Is it one state, two states, 10 states? What is the best solution? And I'll end by saying this, that I think what is very important to understand, and another very powerful component of nonviolence, is that it breaks all the walls of discrimination between peoples and communities. And it brings people to understand the humanity of the other side. The humanity that we are all one. And the word that is completely missing in any language that is being used now to talk about the situation. Yes, we talk about peace. Yes, we talk about justice. But we cannot let the word equality out of the equation as well. We need to see both communities, Palestinians and Israelis, recognize the equal right of the other to be on that land. Something very easy to say, but something very difficult to do, especially when you have ideologies that actually think that God gave them this land and nobody else is supposed to be in there except them. And how do you address these people? Through nonviolence, to expose them and to show them that we are all equal, we are all created by God, in His image, and we all have right to be on this land. And I think for us as an organization, I would say that once this is achieved, once both Palestinians and Israelis recognize the equal right of the other to be here, then we could begin talking about what is the right political solution. Then a one-state solution can be the right solution, because we all live as equals in one state. Or the two-state solution can be a right solution, because these two states have equal opportunities for them. Not one state where minimum wage is $1,000 and the one next to it minimum wage is $150, as we are experiencing now. So I ask you to... I think I'm going over my time. Yeah. Okay, we will open for questions, but let me just say this last message. And I say this as a Palestinian who lives under occupation. It is not my desire to see you engaged in actions and activities that aim to be against anyone. There are big campaigns that are being organized globally. Campaigns that may seem to you as ones that are very much threatening to the other side. But these are nonviolent campaigns that, again, are very important for you to join and participate in. And when we talk about, for example, boycott, divestment, and sanctions, don't be surprised when you hear that there are many Israelis that are actually waiting for you to engage in such campaigns because they know this is where their freedom comes. They know their liberation comes when the world, like what happened in South Africa, when the world engages in this direct actions and activities saying, we're not against you Israelis, we are against the policies, we're against the structures of injustice, and we will be with you and support you by us engaging in these campaigns. So there are many organizations here that are present in this festival that you could visit and see. And I encourage you to join their campaigns, connect with them. If there is anything that we could support you with as an organization, we are ready to support you as well. But the message is always that. Do not look at this as something that is black and white. The poor Palestinians and the ugly, hateful Israelis. There is good and bad happening on both sides. There are many Israelis that are working for peace and justice. And there are many Palestinians that are doing the same thing. And we need to support both of them. Thank you very much for your listening. And may God bless you.
Before we take questions, can I just say that we've decided that we don't need to empty the venue for Jeff Halper, so you don't have to go round again. And we'll take questions now.
There's one over here. Stick hands up and then Linda can see where you are. Any others? We'll start over here. Yeah, I see another hand there, yeah.
Thanks very much for your talk, Sammy. I spent a couple of weeks on the West Bank a few years ago, and my experience was of being in places where there was nonviolent resistance of the type that you describe, and finding it very strongly opposed by the Israeli military, and finding myself asking why are they doing this more and more, and getting more and more confused, and as you suggested, asking myself the question of why Israelis would send their own young people to be abused or abuse their young people by sending them into those situations. And the only conclusion I could come to was that although they say they want peace, actually what the Israeli government wants is the land. And they want that more than they want peace. And so they're abusing their young people, as you suggested, because their ultimate aim is to get the land there. As you said, there's a culture of fear that they're increasing themselves because the ultimate objective is the land. And I wonder if you could comment on that. It seems to me you've got huge forces against you if you're trying to heal that fear.
Yes. Yeah. As I said before, and part of it is very much connected with the issue of fear. If we look back at Jewish history, we cannot deny the fact that Jews, especially who lived in Europe and in Russia at that time, lived in situations where there was continuous violence used against them. Now, what has happened, without going too much details into history, is that there was a movement within the Jewish community to say that we are being abused, we are being destroyed as a nation, and we need to have a place of our own. The Zionist movement arose from that agenda, and it arose and it was abused by their own leaders of the Zionist movement at that time. As I said, historically, when we look at areas like Palestine, when we look at countries in the Middle East, countries that did not even claim to be democratic, had Jews, Christians, and Muslims live together fairly in fair conditions, in peaceful conditions, and so on. And it was the situation of the Zionist movement that came from Europe that actually began this movement to cleanse the Palestinian areas, to cleanse historic Palestine from its original inhabitants and create a homeland for the Jewish people. And again, they were able to sell this to the Jewish community, sell this to the global community through the mentality of fear. Now, what has happened since that time is that it has become sort of a monster that has taken over its own agenda. And this is where I come and make and claim and say that the Zionist movement as a movement is the movement that is really destroying the Jewish roots. It is a movement that has made anything linked with Jews immediately linked as something to do with security, as something to support the existence of a state. So an entire focus of a religion has now folded on one thing only, which is the state of Israel. As if by the destruction of the state of Israel, the entire Jewish existence would be destroyed now. And the mentality of fear and the psychology of fear is one that is being used and abused by the Israeli government to again take as much land as possible with as little people as possible. As I said, the West Bank, which is where the majority of the Palestinians live, will end up being only 40% of the land. They will take 60% of the land and only give 40% to the Palestinians to establish the state. And this state, if we look at it again, would resemble exactly what we're seeing in, or saw what happened in South Africa. It is creating an apartheid Bantustan system where it is their land and they are allowing us to live on that land until they get rid of us. So for us, there are many issues to address, as I said. And for me, it all comes down to the Palestinian community. As a person, as a human, as a believer in God, I believe and know that in every person, this light of God exists. No matter who he is, no matter what their ideology is, no matter what their views are, I actually, as a person, I'm ordered to love this person by God, to love my enemy. Loving my enemy means that I know that in this enemy, there is a conscience that needs to be awakened. And every act, every action I do has to be in that healing. As a Palestinian, when I want to engage in nonviolence, as I said, it's not just about resistance anymore. It's not easy, as you made the claim, but for me, I feel it's the only way to move forward. We have to break the structures in Israeli society itself that has caused a Jewish religion to become an abusive religion of another people. And the way to do that is by us exposing the injustice and engaging in nonviolence. There is no easy answer where I could say we need to do 1, 2, 3. But through dialogue, through nonviolence, through action, I think it is happening. And we're seeing this happen in Israeli society where there's now actually a movement in Israeli society that is questioning the roots of Zionism in Israel itself. And we are seeing this happen also across churches in the West. You know, the Zionist movement in Israel is very much supported by the Christian Zionist movement in the West, especially in the United States. A movement that has given blind support to the Jewish people, millions and billions of dollars for them that go to even the settlements and go for the settlers to buy weapons. These are Christians. They're actually buying weapons to give to a people to kill another people in the name of God. And there are now movements in the evangelical church in the U.S. that are beginning to even question that entire theology itself. I've been invited to speak in churches where I would say 2 years ago they would have kicked me out. And now they are asking me and other Christian leaders from Palestine to come and tell them about what is going on there. So things are moving, slowly moving. What I hope is that by the time things begin to move in a very productive way, that there will be something still called Palestinians that live on that land.
Thank you. I want to ask one question as a Jew and one question as a Christian. I say as a Jew because I'm son of a Jewish father, and so if people were wanting to identify you to ethnically cleanse you in some way because you were Jewish, then I would count. And using that, I feel morally obliged to work with Jews for Justice for Palestinians in the UK, which is a very moderate organization because it tries to be an umbrella group. But I was so pleased that you keep making reference to the Israeli peace movement and also the state's effort, the State of Israel's effort to equate Zionism and Judaism. And I think it's very important for Jewish people around the world to stand up and say, actually, you can be Jewish and non-Zionist or even anti-Zionist, and that's Jewish too, and take that ideological battle forward. So I'm really pleased that you've encouraged that and highlighted that. As
Amen.
A Christian,
thank you.
As somebody who goes to church, I'm always hesitant to call myself a Christian, but that's another story. I do go to church, and I go to church in this country. And there's another thing you said, which really I felt maybe it would be great to hear more about, which is when you said you didn't want to blame the British for their colonial past. And I think this is something that actually does really need to be explored. And your whole discourse helps us to open that up and to look at histories of colonialism, subjugation, occupation, and start to take ownership and responsibility and to rework that. And one of the things that in churches we need to do is to make it okay to start to talk about colonialism, British colonial history and colonialism in general. One of my dear friends died in Bethlehem as a ecumenical accompanier, John Aves. You may have known him. And he was writing letters home saying the same thing as you about seeing God in the other. And he had become anti-colonialist through his work in refugee camp next to Bethlehem. And I think through what you're doing, you can help us in a broader way to deal with the easygoing nature we have towards new forms of colonialism and imperialism that Britain as a state is involved in at the moment. As Christians, we need to stand up and more than question that. And I really want to thank you for helping that process as well.
Thank you. That was beautiful. I don't think I need to comment on that. Thank you for that. Thank you for the sharing.
Hello, Sammy. I spent 5 years in Bethlehem, and I know your mum and dad, and they're coming to visit our church in November. Thank you very much for that excellent talk. I'd like to know from you one thing. Do you think there's any hope at all for a two-state solution, or has it all gone too far for that? And the other question I have, really, I think perhaps you could answer a little bit more depth about the question of healing the fear that you so eloquently talked about, because this is a huge subject, and I would just like some clues on what you intend to have as your weapons to heal the fear of the enemy. Thank you.
Thank you. Well, in terms of the first question, technically speaking, the idea of the two-state solution is as good as dead. Technically speaking, Israel has taken over, the Israeli government has taken over all the resources that would allow for a Palestinian state to be a sustainable state in the West Bank. The way the wall is being built, for example, now, if you take a map of the wall and put it on a map of the water cisterns and aquifers in the West Bank, you will notice very quickly how the wall actually is done in a way where all the water resources are on the other side of the wall. As Palestinians now, we actually have to buy the water that is underground in the West Bank from the Israeli government. We buy 80% of it from the Israeli government at 10 times the cost that the Israeli settler pays for that water. So this is just one example. Then we talk about agricultural land. The whole area which is the eastern area of the West Bank, the Jordan Valley, which is the most fertile ground, is now becoming on the other side of the wall. So agriculture, water, everything that is being done now, the way the wall is being built to divide the West Bank into three areas, not having any access into Jerusalem, everything that's being done is destroying that two-state solution. What is being created is very similar to what, I don't know if people heard Netanyahu's speech when he spoke a few weeks ago. I mean, in a sense, he said, this is all our land, and we will allow them to live here. And if they want to call it a state, let them call it a state. If they want to have a flag, let them have a flag. If they want to have a government, let them have a government. But this is ours. Everything underneath it and above it is ours. And actually, we should be, as Palestinians, thankful for the hospitality to be allowed to stay there. This is the message that is given to the world by the Israeli government. So the two-state solution is as much as dead. The issue of fear, and this becomes the very important issue to talk about, and I believe it is a core issue. As a Palestinian, I do not want to be in a situation where I am defending or legitimizing the Israeli actions because they come out of fear. And this is where nonviolence becomes powerful, because you actually stand and oppose them and say that you will not allow these actions to take place. But at the same time, you are addressing the underlying causes of what causes this to happen. As a Palestinian, what I would like to see is not the Israelis apologizing for what is happening to the Palestinians first, but to see statements coming up from Palestinian leaders where they are really able to say that we know what's going on. Yes, you use the security argument all the time, but what is security? It is just a macho term of saying I'm afraid. It's a macho term of saying I want to keep my country afraid as well. And I want to see religious leaders from around the world, Christians, Jews, and Muslims, be able to come up with these powerful statements as well. For me, the actions that I do is when I engage in a nonviolent action, be it in a demonstration or resisting the building of the wall or something, I try to be in that awareness and this consciousness that this Israeli soldier who is standing in front of me is coming from that background. You know, there are many Israelis who join us in these nonviolent actions. And sometimes what we are seeing is that the nonviolent Israeli activists are actually more violent than us, because they become very verbal against their own military and soldiers. How dare you do this to other people? And they're yelling at them and shouting at them. And again, in this psyche, in this brainwashing that the soldier had, this goes into it, into his mind, and says, well, he's also the enemy. Doesn't matter if he's Jew, doesn't matter if he's Israeli, he's also the enemy. And they actually get abused. The Israelis who participate with us in the nonviolent actions are more abused than us. You probably saw that when you were there. For me, if we want to talk about the issue of fear, I would actually say that when it comes to a nonviolent action, the way to understand if it is addressing the soldier or not addressing the soldier is by how that soldier interprets your action. I could stand in a demonstration and claim to be it nonviolent, but if that soldier in his heart actually has a fear from my action, then to him and to me it should be a violent action. And the only way that I can address this is by knowing what is happening in that soldier's heart at that moment. And once you do this, and you begin this conversation or talk with a soldier, I've seen it time and time over again where these soldiers break down and cry. Literally, they fall on the ground, tears coming out of their eyes. They just cannot handle it anymore. They cannot excuse it anymore. They cannot justify their action anymore. What am I doing on this farmer's land? He has never threatened me. He has never done anything wrong to me. I live in Tel Aviv. I am, 100 kilometers away from him. What threat is he to me and to my family? And once he gets this message, you touch something in their heart. Now, some people are as easy as that. Sometimes, there's this layer of dust where you just have to blow on it and their heart is opened. But with others, we need some heavy machinery, like serious heavy machinery, because there's a lot of things that I have combined over the years: hatred, fear, biases, stereotypes. And this is why I say, as Palestinians, it is our responsibility to address all of these issues and build strategies to do that.
I'm sorry, there were other hands that went up, but time has beaten us. But thank you for letting us stay in here longer, so we got a bit longer. Appreciate that. Tremendous talk from Sami. I think, can we just show our appreciation? Thank you very much, Sami.